Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm tired, David. I stayed up very late watching the election returns here in the UK.
Okay, all right. As did lots of people. So,
did you?
I stayed up until about midnight.
Right.
Right. So the topic we're going to discuss is actually something that is equally sort of timely as the British election. And that is, as we are recording this, the House Judiciary Committee is considering articles of impeachment for President Trump and will be voting on them and presumably passing them sometimes in the next couple hours of the time we're recording this. So we want to talk about the history of articles of impeachment and sort of the ways and how this particular set compares to its three predecessors with Johnson, Nixon, and Clinton. But before we do that, I guess we should probably, you know, talk at least a little bit about the election that just happened here in the UK. You've lived here a lot longer than I have, and I don't feel like I have a good sense of British politics, or at least not as robust as you definitely do. So what was your immediate reaction to the events of last night, in which the Tories won a fairly substantial majority in Parliament? And
well, and of course the SNP won a substantial majority up here in Scotland. Yes. So we are in interesting times, as the cliche goes. I mean, I'm not an expert in British politics by any means. I don't think it was entirely surprising. One thing I saw on social media as I was watching the returns come in overnight was especially a lot of American commentators, pundits, in some cases historians, chiming in and drawing conclusions about the Democratic race, the ongoing Democratic race, from what happened here last night. I'd be a little cautious about that. Basically, the way the interpretation goes is, the predominant interpretation seemed to be, you know, what happened to Jeremy Corbyn here in the UK indicates that the Democrats should not opt for Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, because if they do, they will be defeated by a right-wing bloviating figure. And that danger, of course, exists. But I don't think it's that easy. I think there were some... there are some similarities between what's going on in U.S. politics and the realignment that's going on in U.S. and U.K. culture and politics, but I think there are important differences. I mean, Brexit, this was an election about Brexit.
Yeah.
And I think it was very much a Brexit election. And this is, we're not getting a Brexit referendum. We had it yesterday, and it was pretty clear whether one agrees with that outcome or not. Mm. That's, I think, the case. So we are now leaving the European Union, I think, fairly certainly on January 31st.
Who's the we there, Kimosabe?
All of us in the UK.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, but whether you agree with it or not, David, we're leaving.
Oh, I know. Well, the UK is leaving. I mean, I think one of the things people are considering is about sort of their, you know, questions about, you know, especially for those of us who are non-citizens of the UK, or considering sort of the positions that people have vis-a-vis, you know, considering what the Brexit means for immigrants either from the EU or from the non-EU.
Sure. I mean, paradoxically, I think it's less, it will have less effect on people like you and me who are from outside of the EU than it will for the 3 million Europeans who live in the UK. But I'm saying we, in reference to everyone who resides in these islands, in this island and Northern Ireland, we'll be leaving the UK, leaving the EU. That was a Freudian slip.
That may also happen
on
too.
January 31st. What it means for people who live in this part of this island,
yes,
the Scotland that is, remains to be seen. Again, based on social media, and in this case it was on both sides of the Atlantic and beyond, there was a lot of, oh, Scottish independence is inevitable talk last night and then continuing today. And I'm getting text messages and WhatsApp messages to that effect from friends and family. I'm a little more cautious on that question insofar, and this is analysis rather than opinion. Well, analysis is opinion, of course, but I'm not venturing an opinion on the independence question. I have an opinion on that, but I'm not sharing it now. That might be for a later time. What I would observe is the SNP, the Scottish National Party, share of the vote last night within Scotland was 45%, which is why they won 48 seats. They're in a dominant position. They've won three straight general elections here in Scotland. So they are, without a doubt, the dominant party. There's one Labour MP left in Scotland, Ian Murray in Edinburgh South. So I'm not in any way questioning the dominance of the SNP, except to say 45% of the popular vote, if we take that as a shorthand for what they might get in a referendum, 45% is what they got in the independence referendum back in 2014. And yes, it remains to be seen, the constitutional arrangement between Holyrood, which is where the Scottish Parliament is, and Westminster, which is where the UK Parliament is, the current arrangement, at least, is that the UK Parliament would have to approve a second independence referendum before it could be held. And I think we're in a situation where we have England and the rest of the UK, well, England and Wales, dominated by one party, that is the Tory party, and Scotland dominated by another party, the Scottish National Party. Those two parties are diametrically opposed on the question of independence, and it remains to be seen.
And on many
other things. On many other things. And it remains to be seen how that deadlock will be broken. I think we're headed towards a very interesting constitutional conflict over this question. Now, if you want to be truly Machiavellian about it, you could argue that actually the Tories in England would like to see Scottish independence because it would remove resistance and opposition to their rule, and Tory rule in what's left of the UK would be even stronger.
To be sure.
I don't know whether that's true or not, and this is where we get beyond my expertise, but all I'm saying is I'm not sure, while the SNP position in Scotland is very, very strong, I'm not sure that necessarily equates to independence. It's like looking at the Electoral College map in the U.S. So, you know, the map at the moment is predominantly yellow, representing SNP-held constituencies. But again, it's 45% of the popular vote was in favor of the SNP.
The one wrinkle I would throw into that is if there is another Scottish independence referendum, the people who are eligible to vote in the next one, if it's the same as the people who are eligible to vote in the last one, would include people who are resident in Scotland who are not citizens were able to vote in the last independence referendum.
Right.
Whereas they were not allowed to vote yesterday, so there's lots of EU residents.
That's a good point.
And 16-year-olds and all these kinds of people.
Yeah. So the electorate is slightly different. It's not exactly the same. That's an excellent point.
That could be a margin of
difference. Who knows?
I mean, as our listeners know, our expertise is in the past and not in the future.
And even that's pretty dubious.
Yes, and in an entirely different country. Let's go to the past.
Sorry, David, but one thing where I do think there's a parallel with what's happened in the United States. So in other words, I don't want people to jump to facile conclusions about the race for the Democratic nomination based on what happened in the UK. On the other hand, I do think there's a realignment going on where the Conservative parties, in both the US and the UK, have increasingly consolidated their power and their support among white working class voters combined with wealthy people. Edinburgh, the sole Labour member from Scotland is very interesting. He, Ian Murray, does not represent a post-industrial district in constituency in Glasgow. He represents Edinburgh South, which includes Morningside, which, if you know Scotland, is very posh.
Yes.
And the Labour Party, like the Democrats in the US, is increasingly, I think the results show, a party of urban, middle-class, educated voters, plus non-white working-class voters.
Yes.
So the demographic shifts and the alignment, the realignment that's going on in politics on both sides of the Atlantic, I think there are some parallels there. I just don't think there are necessarily direct parallels. We don't know yet in terms of how the election's going to unfold in the two countries.
All right. Well, yeah, we will see how this will be. Interesting times.
Yes, we do live in interesting times.
For better or for worse. Right. So let's talk about the history of our articles of impeachment.
Let's start, David, with your good boy. So there are four historic, there are four instances, impeachment episodes in American history. We're in the fourth. There's Andrew Johnson's impeachment after the Civil War in 1868, and I'm going to hand the microphone over to you in a moment. There's Richard Nixon's the incomplete impeachment of Richard Nixon in 1974. There is the impeachment of Bill Clinton in December of 1998, and now we're in the Trump impeachment right now. I think we stipulated, certainly before we went on the air, that we want to only concentrate on the articles in this case, because we have a feeling there's going to be an impeachment trial, and we might talk about impeachment trials in a later episode. And we've touched on impeachment.
It can be all impeachment all the time.
Yeah, well, unfortunately. So we really want to focus on articles of impeachment, and I think we need to start with, I was going to say, your boy, Andrew Johnson, although you're my friend, David, so I won't call Andrew Johnson your boy.
Yeah, you know, I probably wouldn't get along
so
too
could
well.
You just give us, I suspect, apart from our listeners who are historians, that for many of our more casual listeners, they will be less familiar with Andrew Johnson. So if you give just a brief background on Johnson, and then we can talk about the articles.
Yeah, but before that, Johnson's actually not the first person who has bills of...
No, I know. We're talking about presidents.
Well, but not only were there people who are judges and things who were impeached, there were actually earlier presidents who had bills of impeachment filed against them in the House, but they just didn't get anywhere.
Right.
So John Tyler had a bill of impeachment against him because he only became president when William Henry Harrison died, and so his legitimacy was questioned in the beginning. He gets impeached because he didn't vote the right way or didn't... support the tariff. Polk also had bills of impeachment. Buchanan, similarly. So there were other times where this sort of motion, people in the House had taken preliminary steps towards impeachment, but Johnson's really the first.
Which
one
is interesting because, and we shouldn't belabor these, only insofar as there was a point at which impeachment could have been the equivalent of trying to remove a leader in the parliamentary system.
Yes.
But it didn't evolve that way.
Yeah, it became a very uncommon process.
Right.
But, you know, looking at the way it happens in the 19th century, it actually, there's moments in which it looked like it would have been a very common process. And that's a moment in which Congress had a lot more power vis-a-vis the presidency in terms of how power is distributed in Washington.
So let's get to Johnson, though.
As I think the sort of cliff note version of Johnson... is a Southern Democrat. He's from Tennessee. He becomes Abraham Lincoln's vice president when he runs for re-election in 1864 and takes office in March of 1865. He is on the ticket to try to signal national unity, to try to sort of bridge the divisions caused by the Civil War, which of course at that point is still... taking place. He's the one Southern Democrat in the Senate who didn't leave when the South seceded. And Johnson then sort of takes over right when Lincoln is assassinated at the very end of the war, and is immediately he, over the process of the next year or so, comes into substantial conflict with Congress over the direction of Reconstruction. And the conflict is in part over the policies about Reconstruction, about which states to readmit and how to readmit them and who to give pardons to and the status of African Americans and what life after slavery would look like. So that's sort of half the fight is about policy and half the fight is about who constitutionally has the power to enact Reconstruction, whether that power rests with the presidency, like Johnson claimed, or whether it rests with Congress or some combination thereof. And so... by 1868, there's a series of bills that Johnson vetoes that Congress had passed, a Freedmen's Bureau bill and a Civil Rights bill.
His behavior is also erratic as well.
Johnson's a chronic alcoholic. He's a very combative politician. He tends to insult people a lot. He said that some of his political opponents should be hanged. He threatened violence against people in the House. So, and he threatened...
Luckily, we don't have presidents
anymore. And he threatened violence people in crowds. People would heckle him, and he would, threaten to beat them up. So there is some similarities, and I guess the difference is that... Johnson was born poor and Trump was born very rich, and Johnson was an alcoholic and Trump doesn't drink. But other than that, there's some similarities to their politics. The actual sort of trigger for his impeachment was the violation of something called the Tenure of Office Act, which was a law passed by Congress that would require congressional approval for removing cabinet-level officials who have been confirmed by the Senate. So the idea, I guess, is if the Senate confirms people in order to fire them, you also need the Senate to replace them.
But that would have actually, I mean, it was a real assertion of congressional power over the president. And you're right, in the 19th century, the balance was more in Congress's favor than the president's. But the Tenure of Office Act was an attempt by Congress to really limit Johnson's
power. Well, so one of the things that they had already done is they'd already overridden his vetoes. And so what Johnson was doing then was effectively undermining the policies that Congress had established by appointing people to run those programs, largely in the Army, who didn't believe in them.
Right.
So, you know, it's about protecting the rights of African Americans, running all these kinds of things. Johnson said, fine, if I appoint people who will listen to what I say, then Congress can pass whatever bills it wants, but the policy won't actually be enacted. And Johnson, who in some ways, like Trump, is a never backs down from a fight, despite this law, tries to fire Edwin Stanton, who was the Secretary of War.
And he deliberately did so to challenge the law. Is that correct?
That's Johnson's position.
Right, okay.
You know, and there's this whole thing where the guy who's supposed to replace Stanton goes and is actually told to go to Stanton's office and tell him he's been fired. And Stanton, like, barricades himself in his office and says, no, you can't fire me because the law says you can't fire me. And so there's actually like a physical standoff and orders the other guy to get arrested. It's complicated. But
it's nice to know the politicians were idiots in the 19th century as well.
And you know, this is an era in which politicians are beating each other over with canes and threatening each other with knives and all the stuff that Joanne Friedman talked about in her book. But it's this firing or attempted firing that leads to Congress to vote on impeachment 3 days later. Right. And so it's a fairly immediate.
That's February 24th, 1868.
Right. Yes. And the vote is overwhelming and partisan. It's 126-47. There's a couple people who abstain. One of the things that's interesting about this compared to later impeachments is that Congress votes to impeach, or the House votes to impeach first, and then assigns people to come up with articles of impeachment afterwards. Rather than the procedure that has been the case with the other impeachments where people, they draft the articles first and then they have a House-wide vote.
Right. So what we've seen over the past couple of months, for example, with President Trump is an investigation first in the House Intelligence Committee and latterly in the Judiciary Committee.
Mm.
And the Judiciary Committee right now is voting on these articles. Well, it's debating these articles of impeachment. We'll vote on them today, presumably, yes, before it goes to the full House. What happens with Johnson is the House votes, basically saying he committed high crimes and misdemeanors, and then they put the articles together, more or less, the charges he has to answer after the fact.
Well, in some ways, it's kind of like the Continental Congress voting for independence on the 2nd of July and then agreeing what the reasons were afterwards.
Right, okay.
Thanks
for coming up with an analogy. I can
understand. There we go. We work Thomas Jefferson into every episode just to make sure that Frank is
grounded. It's a legal requirement.
Exactly. they end up adopting 11 articles of impeachment. There's a fairly lengthy process for this. Nine of which, the first nine, are all sort of various versions of him violating the Tenure of Office Act.
Yeah, and they're quite detailed about aspects of it, aren't they? They're quite granular.
You know, he told this person to do this, and told this other person to do that, and fired this person, and those are very specific. The final two are the I think the interesting ones, sort of going.
They're really interesting, I think.
I guess we Article 10 was he attempted to bring into disgrace, ridicule, hatred, contempt, and reproach the Congress of the United States.
That's Donald Trump's Twitter feed.
and they actually cite in their speeches that Johnson had made that were critical of threats of violence towards members of Congress. And then the last article is about basically all that same language, bringing disgrace upon the president, the office of the presidency.
Yeah, disgrace and ridicule to the presidency.
Right.
So David, these are interesting. So in terms of, again, we're going to set aside the trial for a later date. episode, but it seems to me interesting that we have, with the Johnson impeachment at least, quite detailed articles, those first nine, but those last two are interesting because they really are catch-alls, more or less bringing Congress into disrepute or undermining Congress and bringing the presidency into disrepute.
Yes.
And so high crimes and misdemeanors, at least as Congress defined them in this first presidential impeachment in 1868, the emphasis, if you will, is on the... There are crimes there, the first nine, but those last two are more general. And maybe those are germane for the subsequent impeachments?
I think that they could be. Those are, I think, probably the broadest... of looking at all the articles of impeachment that have been issued, all the ones in the 20th century and 21st century, I think those are the broadest ones that have ever been issued in terms of bringing disrepute upon the office of the presidency. But you can claim that for any president, potentially, depending on...
Your political perspective, right?
Exactly, right? If you have a supermajority in Congress, you could... claim that anybody was doing that because you didn't like what they were doing.
What's interesting to me, David, as well, is, okay, we have 11 articles for Andrew Johnson. My quick math, looking at the three subsequent impeachments, including the ongoing one, we have 11 articles in each total in those. Again, we don't want to deal with the trial yet, but was 11 too many?
Well, they could have done three, right?
Violating the Tenure of Office Act, and then the
other two, right? In some ways, one way to think about the first nine is the first nine are all sort of, could be all one big one if you wanted to. I think they sort of divided it up to give senators an option about sort of investigating each of them individually. I mean, the thing about the Tenure of Office Act in some ways was the pretense for impeaching. Politically, the real reasons for impeaching him had to do with the sort of broader patterns of behavior for the past 2 years and the ways in which he was undermining congressional efforts to make Reconstruction meaningful. That's why he was impeached. I mean, impeachment is coded always in the sort of legal framework of a trial and, about violating laws and being indicted and all these kinds. And it's a fundamentally political act, and they were impeaching him for political reasons.
Yeah, interestingly, Reconstruction doesn't figure that much. I mean, there's a little bit. There are a couple of articles about with reference to stealing from the secretary or using the Department of War to steal
exactly
and corruption. But they're not. Reconstruction itself doesn't feature in these.
The Civil War and Reconstruction do not explicitly factor.
Even though that's what this impeachment is all about.
To be sure.
And if there's one thing I think in reading all the various articles of impeachment in preparing for this episode, what's clear is there's a lot more going on than the articles can encompass. In the same way that the New York Times reported over the past couple of days that President Trump is slightly incredulous that Ukraine is what they're impeaching him for. The implication being they got me for this, not all the other things. But of course, impeachment's always about the specific thing, but it happens in an environment where there's a lot more going on.
Yeah, to be sure. The one other thing I want to point out about the Johnson impeachment articles and in fact, the entire event, is how fast it all happens. Right? Well, one of the things you hear some Republicans saying today is, wow, we're rushing through this too fast. And there's some Republicans who want to rush really fast for other reasons. But the entire impeachment of Johnson, starting from when he violates the Tenure of Office Act to when they have the vote to when they have the articles, all that happens within basically 2 weeks.
Right.
And even
there aren't extensive hearings.
No, they don't need to have extensive hearings because Johnson admitted to what and in fact the trial only takes place when it does because the Johnson team asks for extensions. I think the Republicans in the Senate at the time wanted to go ahead with the trial right then and there. And it was only reluctantly that it actually stretched out over, a couple of months. But it actually could have been a much faster. So, the objection that no one's ever been impeached this quickly, that some Republicans have made in recent days, I think requires ignoring one of the three prior examples we've got of this. One of the two and a half prior examples, yes. I guess, if we want to. Let's go to the half example then.
Yeah, so we go forward a century, and to some extent, I think the next two, the Nixon impeachment articles and the Clinton ones, if you will, they're really conditioning what's happened. There's a more direct correlation. Well, those last two articles against Andrew Johnson, I think, are directly germane to Trump.
Yes.
I think in terms of some of the personnel involved and the precedents that the Nixon impeachment of 74 and the Clinton impeachment of 1998 are more germane for us. So when Nixon was, when the House passed articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon in July of 1974, of course, it was 2 years after the Watergate break-in. It was after extensive investigations and hearings. It was an incredibly complicated complex investigation, and indeed a complicated scandal that involved many, many players, some major, some minor. And this was the culmination of a long period of hearings and press coverage and so on. I mean, it was a very different media environment than the one we exist in today. But there were five articles of impeachment proposed against Nixon, three of which were adopted. So the first three, those that were adopted, were obstruction of justice, abuse of power, contempt of Congress, but also there were two more that were rejected, usurping Congress and tax fraud. And I thought the tax fraud one was interesting. I'd forgotten about it, frankly, until I did the research for this, because one of the things, the Emoluments Clause was mentioned in the debate over that, and one of the things in thinking about the articles proposed by the House Judiciary Committee this week that came up was, well, should they have a long list of Trump's transgressions, or should it be relatively small and easy to comprehend? And they seem to have gone for the latter. And in 1974, again, the House seemed to have done a little bit of both. It's a shorter list than the Johnson list, but it's longer than the next two.
Two, sure. And it's an interesting question about sort of how wide a net do you cast, because if you look at the ways in which prosecutors often work in criminal trials, they often try to charge people with everything they can charge them with, hoping that if they can't get them on the top level line, they can at least get them on something else.
Yeah.
Or get them to bargain down to other things. Obviously, that doesn't work quite the same way with impeachment.
Well, and to some extent, though, in 1974, it did work because there was no trial. Because Richard Nixon resigned, pretty certain that the Senate would convict him.
Yes, even before the House even officially voted for impeachment.
That's right. So these.
But there was also, you know, there was talk at the time about including things that, you know, like the tax evasion question. There was people who said maybe we should include Cambodia in the debate over impeachment, right?
Well, and the fourth one over usurping Congress was really related to the bombing of Cambodia.
Right. So there's these questions about sort of, you know, and they ended up going with this much more narrow one linked to Watergate and its cover up, particularly its cover up.
Yeah. So in that sense, I think the Nixon articles are quite similar to what the House is considering now, in that although there was the Watergate scandal, broadly conceived, exposed a lot of things, the articles of impeachment really did focus on the break-in and the cover-up and the associated cover-up.
Yes.
Really. And in the same way that the findings in the Mueller report, which are quite damning if anyone would bother to read the thing, are problematic for Trump, but those weren't included. They haven't been included in the articles of impeachment against Trump.
At least thus far.
That's right. Yeah, but we've got two at the moment.
Mm, so exactly.
It did occur to me, well, maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves, this might not be the only time Trump is impeached. We might be in a case where... So
I want to get to that, because I think it's an interesting question.
Okay, anyway. Okay. Yeah,
let's go with Clinton, because Clinton's interesting in some ways.
Before we move on, I think the Nixon case, though, is the most like Trump in the sense that there was an incident, there were hearings, the hearings resulted in production of articles of impeachment. The process was aborted in the end, but it was the kind of sequence of events was very similar to what we've seen this time, because the Clinton one is a little bit different.
The Clinton
as well.
One is different.
Yeah, but anyway, let's move on.
Well, I mean, one of the ways in which Clinton is different is that Clinton, they didn't have a series of hearings.
That's right.
Before, because the Starr report really sort of functioned that same role as congressional hearings would have had in terms of its legal.
So the contemporary analog would be as if the House took the Mueller report
and said,
we're using this as the basis for articles of impeachment.
And so the Star Report, for those people who haven't read it, Frank, do you want to sort of summarize what it said?
Oh, God.
It was on the bestseller list back in the day.
That's because it was salacious, or it was allegedly salacious. So
it's like four salacious pages.
The Star Report, Kenton Starr was, and you're better on this language than I am, is it independent counsel?
Yes.
Who was employed to investigate Whitewater, which was a land deal the Clintons were involved in Arkansas that was allegedly corrupt. But Ken Starr, who's played a peripheral role in things lately, but Ken Starr, who was the investigator on that, interpreted his brief very broadly to examine all aspects of Clinton malfeasance, real and imagined. Particularly ginned up. This was the very beginning of Fox News. This was the beginning of the kind of contemporary political environment that we're familiar with, although it wasn't nearly as virulent as it is today. And so Starr used his authority to examine, among other things, Bill Clinton's relationship with Paula Jones, who was a woman in Arkansas that he had a relationship with. All this, sorry, I should say and we've talked about this in the past, but for both the Nixon, for Watergate and for the Clinton scandals, the podcast Slow Burn, the first two series of Slow Burn is excellent on both of those.
Yes, it is.
The first one is on Watergate, the second one is on Clinton. Anyway, Starr investigated this. Starr issued a report exploring the various aspects of Clinton's malfeasance. And it was as a result of the investigation of that the Monica Lewinsky scandal was exposed, and as a result of that, Clinton was questioned under oath, and that's what led to the articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton, which were, David, do you want
well,
to...
Well, so there's two articles.
Is there anything to add to the
Starr
report, really?
No, there's a couple in terms of the timing of this, because I think the timing is interesting. They start, the judiciary starts looking into this in October of 1998.
Right.
Which is an election year. And the Republicans are hoping to use this inquiry and the report, the Starr report, to pick up seats in the House and all this kind of thing.
They actually lose five seats, don't they?
Yes. They're expecting to pick up 30 and they lose five. But so they sort of start the process of the impeachment before the election, but then it's actually during the lame duck session that they actually draft the articles of impeachment. And at the same time that they're doing that, Newt Gingrich, who was Speaker of the House, resigns, and there's this whole scandal with the guy who's supposed to replace him, Bob Livingston, who also had some sexual impropriety.
That.
There's all kinds of things that we forget for good reasons, because it's not
the '90s. They were really something.
But so there's this. It happens in this weird political window after the election, before the new Congress takes their seats. And so the impeachment in the House happens in December of 1998, and he has two articles, one lying to a grand jury. This is about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky lying under oath about his relationship to Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah.
And the second is about obstruction of justice, where it was argued that Clinton had instructed Monica Lewinsky and others to give false testimony when questioned when deposed.
Well, there was also an issue of obstruction of justice related to the Paula
Jones case
as well.
Right. So there's a series of issues that they went into more detail. So there's these two ish articles of impeachment with Clinton
that are adopted.
Adopted, right?
Because there are two more.
Two more. You want to talk about the two other ones?
Yeah. So he was also accused of perjury in the Paula Jones case, and a more general abuse of power, which was a bit similar to the Andrew Johnson, catch-all articles. And what's interesting about this is, and again, in doing the research for this episode, I came across something suggesting that the Republicans in Congress didn't expect all these articles to pass, and they wanted to give cover to their moderate members so that they could split their votes and vote in favor of some of them and against others, to go back to their constituents and to be able to say, I was reasonable about this. this wasn't, to use Donald Trump's word, a witch hunt. Right. We weren't out to get Clinton. We treated this in a very reasonable way, because the first two, lying to the grand jury about Monica Lewinsky and obstruction of justice, were adopted more or less on party line votes. Mm. But the second two failed, again, on abuse of power, actually, failed by a lot. So the votes are interesting. So on lying to a grand jury, the article was adopted 228 to 206. On obstruction of justice in the Lewinsky and Paula Jones case, that was adopted 221 to 212, so that was relatively close. But the other two failed, so the perjury in the article on perjury in the Jones case was defeated 229 to 205, and abuse of power was only 148 to 285, or 285 to 148, I should say. And so some of the thinking about this is that those were set up to fail, in order to give moderate members of Congress, Republicans, cover, and some Democrats to cover, to vote for some of the articles but not all of the articles. So it was interesting that well, at least some of the thinking on this is that there was kind of, there were tactics behind drafting these four articles with the intention that only one or two of them would pass.
Right. And I think one of the things that's also, well, there's a couple of things that strike me that are similar to what's going on now. One is there's this question going on now about Democrats who are in vulnerable seats, especially recently elected Democrats who are in traditionally Republican seats.
Who'll be up next November.
Who'll be up next November. Does it jeopardize them if they have to vote for impeachment, next week? So that's going to be, that strikes me as a similar kind of thing where they're thinking about not only, what this means for the people who are voting for their future electoral success. And the other sort of thing that sort of strikes me about the Clinton impeachment and the Trump one in a very different kind of way is I think both of them go into it, Republicans in it with Clinton and Democrats with Trump, they go into it knowing the likelihood of removal is about zero. With Clinton, when they actually had the vote on removal, you're going into the entire procedure knowing that this is a politically important step, but is unlikely to actually produce the results you want. Now, obviously, something could happen with Trump to make that different.
Because you need 67 senators to remove,
you need
to two-thirds, vote in favor of conviction.
You need two-thirds. I mean, the fact that we've had no president impeached, when Johnson...
Well, removed.
Removed, right. Thank you. When Johnson had his trial, it was 35 to 19 in favor of his removal, but that's not two-thirds.
Right.
And so even though an overwhelming majority of senators wanted him removed, he wasn't removed. Given that the composition of the Senate in 1999 and the composition of the Senate, what it will be in 2020, the odds of Trump being removed are pretty small.
Yes, and everybody seems to know that. What I find interesting is, at least at the moment, and who knows how this is going to play out, which is why we'll talk about trials later, but at least one of the strategies the Republicans seem to be toying with, and Mitch McConnell is thinking about this, and say what you will about Mitch McConnell, he's a canny manager of the Senate. You can't see me rolling my eyes, but David can.
Yes.
Listeners.
He's the John C. Calhoun of the 21st century.
Yeah, that's right. They're talking about a really quick trial with almost no testimony.
Yes.
And so what we're getting the testimony front loaded, if you will, by the democratically controlled House in all this, because they do know that. And we've seen, those of you that could tear yourself away from the British election results last night to watch the debate, and I'm definitely using debate with air quotes and skepticism, in the House Judiciary Committee over the impeachment articles, we'll see the strategy of sort of throwing sand in the works that the Republicans seem to have adopted. So the likelihood of this succeeding in the Senate is, as you say, is minuscule, and there's no indication of any Republican senators breaking ranks as yet over this. Maybe they will, but whether it would
it's
require it would and it would require 20 of them to do it, to remove Trump from office. So you're right, but which begs the question why they're doing it. I have my own views on it. I think actually the hearings are important. Mm. We're historians. I think actually establishing what happened and the historic record.
But they're not doing it for us.
No, I know they're not doing it for us, but I think that's important. I think it's also important so that voters know exactly what's at stake next year. So I think there are reasons to do it irrespective of the likely outcome of the Senate. The other thing is, things are impossible till they're not. I mean, Richard Nixon resigned when faced with the prospect of his trial. I don't think President Trump is likely to do that. In fact, I think he's unlikely to do that, but I don't know President Trump's mind. And this is the procedure that that the House has and Senate has. So,
and I think one of the lines that struck me from the testimony last week when they had those law professors on, is one of them said something, essentially they said, if this isn't impeachable, nothing is.
Right.
And therefore, you know, if Congress doesn't act when faced with these sets of facts, then they basically absolve themselves of this particular power. And
we have a president with almost unfettered power. If the right party, if his party or her party is in charge in Congress.
Now, the question then unfolds, what happens, assuming that our predictions about the future are correct, which they probably
rarely are.
Yes. let's assume that the House votes next week on impeachment. They vote to impeach. They have the trial in January, which who knows what's going to happen there, but the Senate does not vote to remove. What is the last year of the Trump presidency look like post-impeachment? Does the choice to impeach then empower Trump to say, look, they couldn't take me out, therefore I can do whatever I want? Or does he then say, geez, I never realized how vulnerable I was, I will rein things in?
Well, those are the only two choices.
No.
But, I think he will definitely say he was exonerated and acquitted, and he will. You know, we know he will say that.
Mm.
And to a certain, in a literal sense, I suppose that's true, or that will be true. On the other hand, this really is an embarrassment to him. Mm. It's only happened three times previously. Once to Bill Clinton, a person he disdains, at least now.
Yes.
He didn't then when Bill Clinton was attending his wedding, but you know, he hates the Clintons and what they represent, and his party does. Richard Nixon and Andrew Johnson are seen as two of the worst presidents in history. This is not a club Donald Trump wants to be a member of. And he will not be able to remove the stain of impeachment from his record, even if he's acquitted, as he will, or exonerated, as he will claim, and so in answer to your question, I think he will be increasingly aware. I don't think he'll learn the lesson.
Hmm.
I think he's likely to become. I mean, he's already becoming more erratic because I actually think he's compromised in some way. I think he's compromised by the Russians, possibly. But I think he's impaired physically, and I don't see him getting better. I mean, I think he tweeted 100 times yesterday morning. It was some figure like that. I think, and let me give you a case in point. This whole Ukraine scandal began, theoretically, the call with Ukraine was what, July 25th of this year. That was the day after Robert Mueller gave his testimony about the Mueller report before Congress, and that testimony was generally seen as a disaster for Mueller and for his report. Now, I think that actually misinterprets it, but that was the media takeaway. And remember, Trump is a president who gets all of his news from the media, especially Fox News. So the takeaway on Fox News was Mueller was a feeble old man. This was a disaster. Trump has been exonerated. And what did he do? The very next day, he asked the president of Ukraine to dig up this dirt on Joe Biden. So let's suppose he's exonerated as he sees it as a result of this process. I don't see that in his mind, particularly with an election looming, there'll be any reason for him to change his behavior. Mm. If anything, his behavior, if this precedent tells us anything, will get worse.
In which case do we end up then with a situation where there's another impeachment? You could impeach twice, potentially.
Especially if he's reelected. Because if we have five more years of Trump...
Things to look forward to. Yeah, dear listener.
We will be in new territory, because it's hard to believe he won't break the law again.
Well, especially if he gets away with this.
If he gets away with this. And Trump, if Trump is reelected, we're likely to get Democratic gains in the midterms again.
Mm-hmm.
And we might even... You could have a scenario where Trump is reelected next November and the Democrats gain next November as well, because of the way the Electoral College... The electoral map works. And so I think it's entirely possible he could... And if he's the first president to be impeached twice... Well, that is a singular achievement.
All right. Well, things for future historians to look forward to. All right.
I can't bear the thought of five more years of this day. Anyway.
All right. Yeah.
Not five more years of the podcast. That would be fine.
Well, it's like Trump cast on Slate, where they were hoping that it would be over by 2 months after they started.
That's right.
They've been doing it for years. All right. Time for last drops. What you got?
I just want to thank my colleagues, and I'm not going to name everybody because I will leave somebody out, and that will be invidious. But we hosted a workshop here at Edinburgh last week that you attended part of,
yes,
David.
Yes, it was excellent.
Called Global 1776, and I'm organizing this with colleagues at Notre Dame and other institutions. My friend Patrick Griffin and I, and Monticello. My friends Patrick Griffin and Andrew O'Shaughnessy and I are taking the lead on this project. And it involves folks at various institutions around the world. And we're preparing for the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence in 2026 by trying to provide some broader context for it and place it in a global context. So we had a workshop last week where we focused on Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, which was also published in 1776. We read the whole thing for the workshop.
For those of you who aren't familiar, this is not a short book.
It's a freaking long book, I'll tell you that. It's five books and it's very long, but reading the whole thing actually was really, really interesting. I won't get into that now, but we ended it all with a plenary session in which during which Annette Gordon Reed and Peter Onuf, so Annette Gordon Reed from Harvard and Peter Onuf emeritus from the University of Virginia, and many of you will know Annette and Peter collaborated on a book several years ago, and they're wonderful when they speak together. Anyway, Annette and Peter had a dialogue about Jefferson and the Scottish Enlightenment. So trying to make that connection between the Declaration of Independence and our theme from last week. And it was wonderful. I mean, you were there.
Yeah, no, it was really good.
And everyone who was there was really, really blown away by it. And we're going to do a series of events like this in the run-up to 2026. So if you, and if you're an academic, if your institution is interested in participating in this, we're seeking, one of the outcomes we want is to design a course on Global 1776 that we might teach at our own institutions simultaneously around the world. So if you're interested in this, send me an email.
Especially if you are in the sort of non-Atlantic world, it'd be great to have people who are, you know,
absolutely,
you
know, yes,
global, yeah, in the full,
yeah,
sense.
Because one of the things we're concerned about this is being a North Atlantic dialogue.
Sure.
And we would like to be global in our approach. So anyway, we did that last week. I want to thank everybody who participated and everybody who attended, like yourself, David, but also to signal that, you know, this is an ongoing project. So if you're interested, drop me a line.
Great.
What about you, David? What do you have?
Well, I want to recommend a newsletter written by the historian Heather Cox Richardson from Boston College. Many listeners will be familiar with her. She had a very good podcast for a couple of years. She's written a number of excellent books on Reconstruction and the history of the Republican Party.
She's very good at public engagement.
She's extraordinarily good at public engagement. And one of the things she's been doing for the past couple months is writing these enormously long, basically Facebook posts every night, sort of trying to put the events of the day into historical context, much in some ways kind of like what we do here on our podcast. But she's, you know, very detailed. You know, this is a lot of effort she was doing into this. People were saying, why don't you share this more broadly? And so basically this is a newsletter that comes out every day that is a reflection by a very talented historian about what happened that day and trying to link that to American political history and try to sort of make sense of what all these events mean.
Where can people find it?
Well, you can subscribe to it. It's called Letters from an American, and I'll put the link in the show notes where people can sign up. But you can get that, so you can get that dropped in your email every day.
Excellent.
All right. Until next time.
Cheers. Cheers. David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.